Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. What happens if Congressman Duncan Hunter is convicted on federal corruption charges after his September trial and then resigns or is ousted from Congress? How and when might the vacancy be filled? Find out on today's show. Congresswoman Susan Davis has announced plans to support the Green New Deal, plus hear about a grant won by the City of La Mesa to go greener by planting hundreds of trees. On Tribal Beat, learn about a dramatic rescue made by Native American runners after a vehicle with three elderly women crashed into a ravine near Inkopa. And on Destination East County, hear about 4th of July festivities and other major events coming up, from Descanso Days to Watermelon Days. Our newsmaker interviews today are with La Mesa Councilmembers Colin Parent and Christina Licio about the future of regional transportation plans and how those could affect East County as well as San Diego. So stay tuned for all of these stories on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, where East County matters.
Congressman Duncan D. Hunter's trial on 60 counts of federal corruption charges is scheduled for September. He is accused of spending $250,000 in campaign funds for personal use and falsifying campaign finance reports to cover up the thefts. Hunter pleaded not guilty, but his wife, Margaret, has changed her plea to guilty on one count of conspiracy and is now cooperating with prosecutors. In her plea deal, she implicated Congressman Hunter in major crimes and told authorities that the campaign treasurer advised the Hunters that their actions were illegal, advice that they ignored. If Congressman Hunter is convicted and either resigns or is expelled by the House of Representatives, a vacancy would be declared and a special election could be called. When or if that could occur, however, depends on several factors. The turmoil leaves the future of the 50th Congressional District in limbo and raises some key questions. We've got answers, and they are complicated. Does Hunter have to leave office if convicted? There is no law requiring removal of a congressman convicted of crimes, even if the member is imprisoned. However, the House of Representatives can choose to expel the member once convicted. With Democrats in the majority in the House, they could bring a vote to eject Hunter, a Republican, but this would require a two-thirds plurality, so some Republican votes would be needed. Or the House could leave Hunter in his seat, even if he's behind bars, a tactic that could help boost his Democratic opponent's chances in the 2020 election. It's also possible that the Republican Party could urge Hunter to resign if convicted, in order for the party to back another Republican more likely to defeat a Democratic rival. Another possibility is that President Donald Trump could pardon Hunter after a conviction, in which case he could remain in office, although the House would still have the option to vote for expulsion if the House Ethics Committee found conduct in violation of House rules. What if Hunter is convicted but won't resign and isn't expelled? Can he still represent his district behind bars? Once convicted, Hunter would be banned from casting votes from a prison cell, leaving his district without representation on legislation. He has already been removed from all House committees pending outcome of his trial. If he is convicted but remains in office without resigning or being expelled, his staff can legally continue to handle constituent casework, such as helping those who have problems with federal agencies such as Social Security, Medicare, or the Veteran Affairs Administration. If Hunter is resigned or expelled, how would a vacancy be filled? The U.S. Constitution requires that all vacancies be filled by election. The governor cannot appoint anyone to fill the vacancy except in a national emergency where there are more than 100 House vacancies. But how and when to convene a special election to fill a House vacancy varies from state to state. California's election code requires that within 14 days of a congressional vacancy occurring, the governor must order a special election. There must be both a primary and a general election called to fill the vacancy, unless one candidate fills 50% plus one vote in the primary, in which case no general election would be held. When would a special election be held? The special primary election must be held on the 9th Tuesday after the governor's proclamation, unless that falls after a Monday holiday, in which case the election would be on the 10th Tuesday. If no candidate wins 50% plus one vote in the special primary, then a general election would be held between 126 and 140 days from when the vacancy occurred. But there's a big caveat that could alter that process. If the vacancy occurs late in the term, after the nomination deadline has closed for candidates to file in a regularly scheduled primary election, then the governor could choose to consolidate the special primary election with the regularly scheduled primary race. In the past, California held its primaries in June, but for 2020, California has moved its primary up to the first Tuesday in March, known as Super Tuesday. The nomination deadline for candidates to file in the March 2020 primary is December 6, 2019. So, if Hunter resigns or is expelled from office before December 6th, a special primary election would be mandatory. Potentially, if Hunter were convicted in September or October and a vacancy declared soon after, a special election could occur as early as December or January. If the vacancy happens after December 6th, it would be up to the governor whether to put the primary race to fill the vacancy on the March 6th ballot to save the taxpayers money or push for an earlier special election. How soon could we have a new representative? Whether the special primary election were held on or before March 6th, the general election or runoff would still have to occur much earlier than the November 2020 general election to meet the 126 to 140-day legal requirement for filling the vacancy after the governor's proclamation. So taxpayers would be stuck for funding a special general election as well as a primary, unless one candidate takes over half the votes in the special primary. Even if the special primary were consolidated with the March 6th primary, the district would have a new representative elected no later than summer 2020, and potentially sooner if one candidate should win over half the votes in the primary. What if Hunter is found not guilty? If Hunter is found not guilty, he could legally hold on to his seat in Congress and run for re-election. It would then be up to voters to determine his political future. With the district's heavy Republican registration advantage, it's quite possible that he could win another term if exonerated, or even after being convicted and serving time. It's also possible that the Republican Party could decline to endorse Hunter and back another candidate in the next primary election. The House sets its own rules, so it's possible that the House could expel Hunter after its own investigation, even if he were acquitted. House ethics rules do provide grounds for ouster if a member violates House ethics rules, which prohibit a member from using campaign funds for personal use. But expulsion without a conviction would be more difficult, given the need for some Republican votes and historical precedent. What if he is convicted but pardoned by the president? If he is pardoned, Hunter could stay in office until the next election, when his future would be up to the voters. A pardon could restore voting privileges that would otherwise be revoked. The House Code of Ethics states that any member convicted of a crime for which a sentence of 2 years or more may be imposed should refrain from participation in committee business and refrain from voting unless they are vindicated, pardoned, or re-elected. Who else may run for the seat? Democrat Amar Campanajar, who came within a few percentage points of defeating Hunter in 2018, has been actively campaigning for the 2020 race. Three Republicans have voiced interest in running, but it is unclear whether they would do so if Hunter remains in office. They are El Cajon Mayor Bill Wells, retired Navy SEAL Larry Wilski, and Temecula Councilman Matt Braun. More candidates could potentially join the race before the December 6th filing deadline for the March primary, or an earlier filing deadline if a special election is called sooner. With such a complex process, one thing is certain for voters in the 50th Congressional District in the next few months. A state elections expert told us it will be a very confusing time. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. Congresswoman Susan Davis announced on June 15th that she will be signing on to support the Green New Deal when she returns to Congress, San Diego Jewish World reports. The announcement came at a presentation on climate change in San Diego, arranged by scientists from Scripps Institute of Oceanography, San Diego State University, UCSD, and Stanford University's Hoover Institute. Davis gave opening remarks and then took a seat in the audience. Multiple audience members urged Davis and the panelists to support the Green New Deal. After the presentation, Davis stepped up to the mic and announced her support for the Green New Deal, adding that she has grandchildren and hopes they will not suffer the effects of climate change. The Green New Deal proposes a high-urgency program to switch the U.S. to 100% renewable energy sources by 2030, actions that California has already led the nation in taking. During the panel discussion, Dr. Walter O'Shell, distinguished professor at San Diego State University's biology department, explained that scientists have known and understood the impact of global warming for many years. It's not lack of knowledge, but a dedicated opposition that blocks actions to reverse the trend of climate change, he said. These opponents, according to O'Shell, are a well-funded, significant group who support fossil fuel. He estimates that the U.S. emits between 7 and 9 billion tons of carbon dioxide every year, and some of that is utilized in photosynthesis by plants. Far more CO2 could be taken out of the atmosphere if there were simply more efforts to optimize growth of vegetation, plants, both on land and at sea. Dr. Kate Rick from UC San Diego's School of Global Policy and Strategy explained that every ton of carbon dioxide emitted into the atmosphere results in $400 of damage to the global economy. But some poor countries that cause only a small fraction of global emissions, such as India, are feeling the worst impacts. Large countries such as the U.S. and China produce the most greenhouse gases and yet have less economic incentives to change their destructive practices, she said. Retired Navy Commander David Slayton from the Hoover Institute said nations around the world recognize that by bringing electricity to rural populations, they can upgrade standards of living in those areas. He said it will require smart, innovative thinkers to accommodate this trend while at the same time reducing the reliance on fossil fuels. Dr. Mark Merrifield, director for the Center for Climate Change Impacts and Adaption at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, said Scripps has been going through a metamorphosis. Now it not only studies what is happening, but is trying to prescribe solutions to problems like global warming. Ricky said, one helpful way to ameliorate global warming would be to enact a carbon tax. Not only would that raise money to study the problem, but it would incentivize consumers to become more involved in finding solutions. O'Shell agreed that a carbon tax is necessary and said people who say the economic cost would be too great are similar to those who argued years ago that a 25-cent tax on gasoline would have a terrible impact on the economy. And yet, the same industry that argued against government increases, the oil industry, has increased the price of gasoline by over $2 a gallon since then. O'Shell also noted that tax breaks for oil companies and other carbon subsidies should be eliminated. Slayton also endorsed the carbon tax, saying 40% of carbon dioxide in the U.S. comes from personal vehicles, 40% from industries, including commercial transportation, and 20% from various products. Merrifield says he's on board for the Green New Deal, which envisions a tax on carbon dioxide producers, but he warns, we still have to remove carbon from the atmosphere, and currently there is not technology to do it. That problem may be a surmountable one, however. When legislation was enacted a few years ago mandating a timeline to eliminate freon from air conditioning systems because it was causing a hole in the Earth's ozone layer, suitable replacements had not yet been developed. But substitutes were quickly developed after the legislation, which replaced 100% of freon, and the ozone layer that protects our planet was restored.
This is John Fisteer with a Green Scene Report. The city of La Mesa has been awarded a $385,000 grant from Cal Fire to support planting trees. The grant will enable the city to plant 200 trees in parks and along right-of-ways to expand the city's urban canopy starting this summer. It's all part of the city's climate action plan. The city will also develop an urban forest management plan through a public process to manage the health of the city's tree canopy for the next 50 years. In addition, La Mesa will provide education and outreach to the public on how to care for urban trees. The city will partner with organizations to implement the grant project, including Urban Core of San Diego County, La Mesa Beautiful, Tree San Diego, and West Coast Arborists. La Mesa has been designated a Tree City USA by the Arbor Day Foundation for the past 39 years, but the CAL FIRE grant will accelerate the city's tree planting efforts. Trees provide shade and aesthetic appeal, along with taking carbon out of our atmosphere. In March of last year, the City Council adopted La Mesa's Climate Action Plan, which charts a course to cut the community's greenhouse gas emissions in half by 2035. The Climate Action Plan calls for planting 500 new trees by next year and expanding the urban tree canopy from 18% to 33% of the city by 2035, helping to sequester carbon, reduce heat island impacts, and heal our planet.
This is the East County Magazine Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities.
Native Americans running from the Fort Yuma Indian Reservation in Arizona to the Sequan Reservation in San Diego's East County, a 150-mile journey, sought to draw attention to the plight of missing and murdered sovereign Native American women. On the morning of June 9th, they wound up saving the lives of two elderly sisters whose vehicle plunged off the I-8 East into a rugged canyon, though a third sister did not survive the crash. One of the tribal members running across the desert in triple-digit heat says, "The Creator put us there for a reason." Just east of the Inkapa Road exit near the Desert View Tower, the runners were about to go into a prayer circle when they saw a car spin around and then disappear. The group waited for traffic to clear, ran across the freeway, and saw the car down in the canyon. According to the California Highway Patrol, the vehicle was a Nissan that veered off the roadway and rolled over several times before coming to rest on its side. One runner called 911 and others ran down into the canyon. Seeing smoke, they realized the car could explode and knew that they had to act quickly to rescue those inside. The runners used rocks to break through windows to reach the victims trapped inside. Two of the women had feet stuck in the wreckage and one had a broken, bleeding foot. The third had a seatbelt around her neck. Tikpatl says, "She was spitting blood, so I called an elder and I used a machete to cut the seatbelt." Officer Javier Amezcua, with the California Highway Patrol, was traveling to San Diego for training when he responded to the scene and helped extricate the victims. He praised the Good Samaritans for their efforts that helped save lives. The Nissan was driven by 73-year-old Leonila Aguilar from Yuma, who was traveling from Yuma with her sisters. She suffered serious injuries and was transferred by helicopter to Scripps Mercy Hospital. The front passenger, 70-year-old Rosa Huante of Yuma, suffered moderate injuries and was transported by ambulance to El Centro Regional Medical Center. Their 83-year-old sister, who was in the back seat, did not survive her injuries. She was a resident of Encinitas, whose name has not yet been released by the authorities. All of the women were wearing seatbelts, and the cause of the crash remains under investigation. The runners continued to their destination at the Sequan Resort, arriving in time for dinner to open a conference on missing and murdered indigenous people and trafficking. They represented multiple Native American tribes, including Navajo, Keshan, Paiute, and the Tejano Odhem Nation. Thanks to their actions, the women in the car that plunged off the freeway were saved from winding up among the missing, and two were spared from death, thanks to the courage of the runners who freed those trapped in the vehicle at the base of a rugged ravine. Reporting for East County Magazine from Inkapa, this is Jonathan Getz.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Valerie Watts
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
July brings Independence Day celebrations, including 4th of July parades in Julian and Alpine, the Lake Murray Fireworks and Music Festival, as well as Independence Day celebrations in Santee, El Cajon, and Poway.
Plus, we'll have even more July events, including the Sunshine Boys at Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa, the Descanso Days Parade and Fair, Watermelon Days at Oasis Camel Dairy, Pine Valley Days, and A Sip of Julian.
We'll also have some all-summer-long events, including outdoor concerts, movies in parks across our region, classic car shows, and dive-in movies at the Croc Center's swimming pool.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
Julian's annual 4th of July parade celebrates the town's Gold Rush history, the dedication of veterans and active duty military members and local residents who cherish the small town lifestyle in the mountains of San Diego's East County. The parade rolls out at 10 a.m. down the town's main street, with activities continuing until 5 p.m. Parade entries include the Gold Drum and Bugle Corps, mariachis, bagpipes, vintage tractors and antique cars, belly dancers, Mr. and Mrs. Apple Days, Supervisor Diane Jacob, and more.
The City of El Cajon invites you to celebrate Independence Day with numerous games, live musical entertainment, and fireworks. On Thursday, July 4th, the El Cajon Recreation Department will host the annual picnic and celebration for the city from 1 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. at Kennedy Park in El Cajon.
The Lake Murray Fireworks and Music Fest will also be held on July 4th, from 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. This event features food, fun, bands, and fireworks. Fireworks will be launched from a barge on the lake for viewing throughout the community. The music fest will be held on the San Carlos side of the lake, but the La Mesa side will also be open throughout the day and evening for fireworks viewing. For more information, you can visit lakemurrayfireworks.org.
Santee Salutes is the City of Santee's July 4th celebration held at Town Center Community Park East from 2:30 to 10:30 p.m. The festivities include live music by the 90s All-Stars, a kids' fun zone, a food area, a patriotic ceremony at 6 p.m. and a spectacular fireworks display at 9. A shuttle service runs from 3:30 to 11 p.m. from the Costco parking lot on Cuyamaca.
Alpine will roll out an old-fashioned 4th of July parade and a carnival from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. The parade includes entries ranging from antique cars to costumed children along Alpine Boulevard, ending at the Alpine Community Center Park, home of the Alpine Veterans Wall of Honor. There you can enjoy live music, a deep pit barbecue, and a carnival with plenty of activities for children and families.
Old Poway Park will host an old-fashioned 4th of July celebration, 20th century style, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on July 4th. The historic park will have patriotic entertainment, Western reenactors, model train displays, crafts, old-fashioned games, and, for a fee, rides on a historic railway. Shuttles are available from Poway City Hall's parking lot and Poway Adult School. After the daytime activities at the park, you can drive over to Poway High School to watch fireworks at 9 p.m.
Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa will present Neil Simon's The Sunshine Boys from July 5th through August 5th on Friday and Saturday nights, plus Sunday afternoon matinees. A young theatrical agent attempts to reunite his elderly uncle, a former vaudeville great, with his longtime stage partner for a TV reunion. For tickets, you can visit lamplighterslamesa.com.
The annual Descanso Days Parade and Fair will take place on July 6th. The parade rolls out at 9 a.m. along Viejas Grade Road. The fair will be held at the historic Descanso Town Hall from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. This year's theme is a blast from the past with live music by the Get Groovin' Dance Band.
It's time again for Watermelon Days at the Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona, July 13th and 14th from 11:30 to 6 p.m. You can feed watermelons to camels, play games such as watermelon splash and toss, watch an exotic bird and animal show, feed miniature sheep in Sheep Town, and even ride a camel. You can find more information at CamelDairy.com.
The Mountain Empire Men's Club will present Pine Valley Days July 26th and 27th. The two-day festival starts with a deep pit barbecue from 5 to 9 p.m. on Friday night and live music by Barb Wire from 6 to 10. On Saturday, there's breakfast at the clubhouse at 7 a.m., followed by the Pine Valley Days Parade at 9 a.m. along Old Highway 80 from the Pine Valley Library to the middle school. Next up, there's a full day of activities in Pine Valley Park, including children's activities, arts and crafts, vendors, live music, food, and a horseshoe tournament. You can check the PineValleyDays.com site to find more information.
A Sip of Julian on July 27th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. will feature 10 tasting rooms offering samples of beer, wine, hard cider, and craft cocktails with small food pairings. Tickets are available at the Julian Town Hall. Proceeds will be used to fund the annual Julian Country Christmas and Tree Lighting Ceremony.
Now for some all-summer-long events. Grab your popcorn. It's time for summertime movies at the outdoor roller skating rink at Viejas Outlets Shopping Mall in Alpine. Showtime start at 7:30 p.m. every Friday night from now through early July. The lineup of popular movies coming up in July includes Star Wars, The Force Awakens, How to Train a Dragon 3, The Lego Movie, Jungle Book, and Inside Out. A full schedule of events is available at Viejas.com in the entertainment section.
The Salvation Army Joan Crock Community Center invites you to a series of dive-in movies that you can watch in the swimming pool. All shows start at 7 p.m. On July 17th, you can watch Hotel Transylvania 3 Summer Vacation, followed by How to Train Your Dragon, The Hidden World, on August 7th.
El Cajon's popular movies in the park run all summer long at parks across the city. The July lineup includes Aquaman at the Fletcher Hills Pool on July 6th, Incredibles 2 at Bill Beck Park on July 12th, Big Hero 6 at Bostonia Park on July 19th, as well as Ant-Man and the Wasp at Kennedy Park on July 26th. Guests can enjoy additional fun activities before the start of the movie at nightfall. For a list of the shows, you can visit elcajonrec.org.
Lemon Grove Summer Concert Series opens June 27th and continues through August 22nd, each Thursday evening from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Berry Street Park. The July and August concerts coming up will include salsa, Cajun Zydeco, rock and roll, Motown, country music, and more. Check the City of Lemon Grove's website calendar for a full schedule of upcoming movies.
El Cajon's popular dinner and a concert series is held each Friday evening at Prescott Promenade in downtown El Cajon from 6 to 8 p.m. Shows will continue all summer long. You can bring a picnic dinner or dine early at one of the restaurants nearby before rocking out at the outdoor concert. A schedule of upcoming performers is available at downtownelcajon.com.
Santee's Summer Concert Series is being held from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Town Center Community Park East on Thursday nights through August 22nd. July's show include the Bill McGee Blues Band, Three Chord Justice, and Bump City Brass. The City of Santee has the full lineup of artists on its website at cityofsantee.ca.gov.
The City of La Mesa's Sundays at 6 concert series continues at Harry Griffin Park in the Outdoor Amphitheater each Sunday evening at 6 p.m. through July 28th. July performers are Wild Nights, Ginger Cowgirl, 8-Track Highway, and Sonic Epidemic. Find more information on the city's website at cityoflamesa.com under Special Events.
The La Mesa Village Association rolls out its La Mesa Classic Car Show each Thursday from 5 to 8 p.m., from now running through August 29th, although there will be no show over the 4th of July weekend. This event features pre-1974 cars, trucks, and vans. The event will feature DJs and live bands located at 3rd and La Mesa Boulevard and an award giveaway at each event honoring the night's best cars. You can find full details at lamesavillageassociation.org.
El Cajon's Classic Cruise Nights is celebrating its centennial season. You can view classic cars every Wednesday from 5 to 8 p.m. along Main Street in the heart of downtown El Cajon. July's car show themes include American Muscle, Off-Road Madness, Groovy Vans, VW Mania, and Thrill Seekers. For a full schedule of events, you can visit downtownelcajon.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section at our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, Or if you'd like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website or Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back soon with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County.
You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for our region.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio here in East County. And today, my very special guests are Colin Parent and Christine Alessio. They are both attorneys on the La Mesa City Council. Christine is the vice chair of the SANDAG Regional Planning Committee and a member of SANDAG, the San Diego Regional Association of Governments, and Colin is the director of Circulate San Diego. And we're here today to talk about transit in San Diego County. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Miriam. Great to be here.
So, Colin, why don't you start by telling us what the goal or goals of Circulate San Diego are for the region?
Yeah, so Circulate San Diego, we're a nonprofit. We operate region-wide. We are a nonprofit think tank, and we will focus on three main areas, public transit, street safety, and sustainable growth. And so what that oftentimes means for public transit is to encouraging transit agencies and local governments to adopt policies and funding to encourage more frequent transit, faster transit, to make transit a more viable choice for people than just driving.
Right. And of course, that's even more important nowadays against the backdrop of climate change and global warming, where it's so important to reduce those greenhouse gas emissions. Christine, from the SANDAG perspective, tell us a little bit about what SANDAG's vision is for transit for the region.
SANDAG has recently hired a new executive director, and as part of that, SANDAG is revealing its five big moves. And a big part of that is prioritizing transit and getting people a meaningful choice instead of driving their car. And that has been the center of a bit of debate recently since it was first unveiled about a month and a half ago.
Yeah, the new director of SANDAG, I understand, is pushing for high-speed rail. Tell us your thoughts on that, and if you agree with it, disagree with it, and what other options there are.
Just to begin with, I would wish that we would have high-speed rail all over the place. But again, I don't think it's realistic to all parts of the county, and it's very costly. I have mentioned right in the newspaper and at the SANDAG board meeting, we really need to dig down to look at the differences between people who desire to use transit in their mindset. They don't want a car. Their freedom means no car, no car payment, no anything, and the people who are never going to get out of their cars and get on transit because to them, personally, their car is freedom. So I think it's a balance that's going to have to be struck, and I'm not sure that high-speed rail, in theory, it's fine, but with limited dollars, and I think Colin will speak to this as well, there may be other ways to get people out of their car.
Yeah, and there's also that conflict of areas like, say, Santee, where there's a lot of new development that's gone in, some of it that was largely opposed by many in the community, and it's created gridlock on 52. So there's the issue of what do you do about the gridlock that you already have on the freeways in areas where it may or may not be affordable or feasible to get, say, a new transit line or a high-speed rail line or something out there. So there's a lot of conflicting information issues that have to be worked out. Now, I understand there's kind of three major initiatives that are coming up or in progress. Let's talk a little bit about that. Colin.
Yeah, so as I've been thinking about it, there's really three major questions that are happening in the region right now. So one is that SANDAG, with our new executive director, is talking about doing an update to the region's plan, the transportation plan, mm-hmm. and he's been talking about prioritizing transit in that. And I think in the broader sense, like, I think that's really great. I've been advocating for a greater focus on transit for some time, and so, you know, we can quibble about whether or not he's, you know, prioritizing the right kinds of transit, but prioritizing transit is is definitely a good thing. The second big piece that's happening is that we have already a half-cent sales tax measure called Transnet that is designed to pay for some transit improvements, some highway improvements, among others. And there's been a discussion or a proposal to take some of the money that's programmed for highways and to reallocate them for transit.
Right. I think that's the part where some of the folks out in East County heard about it and got a little bit up in arms, so to speak, or worried that it might mean long-promised improvements, for instance, to Highway 52 might not happen. And transit sounds great, but what about them?
Sure, yeah. And so you have heard a lot of that pushback from some of the elected officials in East County and North County. What they haven't been saying, though, which is, I think is being left out of this conversation, is that Transnet has less money than they originally assumed that it would.
So there's not enough to really even build all the freeway projects that they promised or all of the mass transit projects that they promised.
That's right. And so when you have these mayors who are railing against the new San Diego executive director saying, oh, you have to keep the promises to the voters and not amend Transnet, the reality is that there's no mathematical way to build all of the highways with the limited dollars that are left in Transnet. So they can oppose amending Transnet to take the remaining highway dollars and moving them to transit. And that, you know, that would protect some of the highway money and would allow more of those highways to be built. But it's not on the table to build all of the highways that were in Transnet. There just isn't the money. So that's kind of, you know, it's not a surprise. Elected politicians are saying things that don't always make a ton of sense, right?
I mean, it's just the world we live in. Right.
But anyway, so that's the second thing. And then the third issue, this sort of happening in parallel to these other two, is that MTS, the Metropolitan Transit System, the transit system that serves San Diego, East County, and South County, is looking at doing a ballot measure to fund mostly transit expansions in our service area. And so those things are all happening together.
Yeah. Now, the question would be, how much would be that Transnet increase they'd be looking for the next time around? And how are they going to make sure that whatever is promised this time is something they actually can deliver? Because, you know, it's hard to keep going back to voters and saying, do this, and then have the rug pulled out and say, oh, but that project you thought you were going to get, you're not going to have. And we don't just see this in transit, of course. We saw it, say, out in Alpine, where voters thought they were voting for a new high school twice on ballot measures, and it, you know, the bond measures and the money got spent on other things. So how would you lay out a proposed increase in the Transnet tax that would be equitable for all parts of the county?
From my standpoint, I think Sandag is floating a 1 cent sales tax increase. And I think to make it as equitable for multiple parts of the county, you have to recognize how the people live, how they are most likely to live. And it may take, you may have to add a managed lane, add a lane to the Highway 52. You definitely are going to have to widen the 67. That's a safety issue. That's a no-brainer. We can't have Paradise, California happen in Ramona. You may need to put some investment into the 94, but you also need to invest in transit where people are apt to use it and want to use it. So in the perfect world, you would have a blend of things and effective. And the goal, the overriding goal, is GHG reductions. We have to make sure the transit we're putting in, people use to achieve those goals. And I'm sure Colin has some other thoughts on it as well.
Yeah, so just to clarify, you know, in the immediate term, Sandag is not proposing a new tax measure to put more money into Transnet. Their plan contemplates new revenue that Sandag may generate, but they're not looking at anything earlier than 2022, probably not anything earlier than 2024. And I actually am doubtful that they're going to put something on the ballot really in the next decade, because it's unlikely that the North County is going to have an appetite for sales tax for transportation, given their performance on a similar ballot measure in 2016. So,
So
what is happening in the more immediate term is that MTS is looking at doing their own ballot measure that would fund transit, active transportation, potentially safe routes to school programs. Those things could fund certain projects that are in Sandag's plans, but that's a sort of a separate question. And their MTS is only looking at a half-cent sales tax measure.
Very interesting. And out of curiosity, since we are the East County Magazine show, what would some of the MTS ballot stuff be that might benefit any portions of East County?
So all that's up in the air right now. And so for your listeners, you can Google, I think it's Elevate 2020, which is the MTS campaign site.
Elevate 2020.
You can provide some input, and you can find out where you can go to community events to provide input about the kind of projects you'd like to see. But some of the things that are, that MTS has been discussing are increased frequencies to the existing trolley lines.
Nice.
Building additional expansions to the trolley lines.
Yeah, you mentioned maybe as frequent as 7 minutes, so the average person would only be waiting 3.5 minutes to catch a trolley once you get there, and that's certainly a lot faster than now.
Yeah, that's right. Right now, if the average trolley service in East County is at 15-minute intervals, and so if you cut that down to 7-minute intervals, your total trip is much less because you're waiting less, and it just is more convenient and pleasant to ride. And also, by the way, what's great about increasing frequencies is it's the cheapest way to improve transit.
So Very interesting.
Building a new trolley is actually really, really expensive, and there's probably good reason to do that in some circumstances, but the cheap, easy things are also important to do, and increasing service is one of them. Let me just add one other thing. Well, the other thing that MTS is actively looking at doing in their measure is connecting the trolley to the airport. And that is something that I think makes a lot of sense to a lot of people.
Yeah, it's amazing that they haven't done that yet. What about bus service?
Yeah, MTS is actively looking at that. That's almost certainly going to be a part of a measure. And a bus, actually, if it has high frequencies, if it has dedicated right-of-way, mm-hmm. it can get as many people just as fast as a trolley for a fraction of the price.
Right. I think a lot of people would like to ride the trolley, but if they don't live within walking distance of it, then what? You know, or if they don't have a car and they're not within walking distance, then... Now, there's also a regional transportation plan that SANDAG is wrestling with right now. Christine, can you give us an update on that?
SANDAG could not put together a regional transportation plan that would meet state guidelines for GHG reduction. So they went to the state, they said, please, can we have extra time? We had to have an assembly bill that would allow that. And so now they're in the process of making their new plan. I expect it to be unveiled sometime in November to the SANDAG board. Mm-hmm. It does prioritize transit, but primarily in the way of brand new high-speed projects such as linking Poway to Sorrento Valley and down. And so I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done on it because I'm not sure that they are going to get the best bang for their buck. And I do think that you are going to have in there some highway projects. In La Mesa specifically, I mean, we've been promised the 94-125 interchange for 30 years, and they're telling us, we can't build it, we have no money. Well, that, going back to the Transnet, that is the kind of thing that really turns voters off, and I know, like, the Grossmont Mount Helix Improvement Association is starting to come to SANDAG meetings, the Casa de Oro Business Alliance is coming to SANDAG meetings, mm-hmm. and so the new plan and that's the existing plan, but the new plan is also going to need to take into consideration the needs of less dense communities that by virtue of just the fact there isn't the density to have effective transit, they're going to need something for roads or highways or money. But my biggest concern with the SANDAG plan is how are you going to pay for all this and is it an effective use of money?
Right, because every taxpayer in the county would be paying for it. And so, again, it's that equity thing of if you're going to ask a taxpayer to pay for a tax increase, what's in it, you know, for that taxpayer? Or are they supposed to be doing it, you know, altruistically because it's reducing greenhouse gases, but by making things better for folks in Poway or Sorrento Mesa? But if you're in Alpine or El Cajon, you know, maybe there's not as much. So it's an interesting thing. But on the other hand, there's not enough money to do everything, as Colin has noted. So it's a difficult dilemma, I think, that these folks are in.
And I think what makes it more difficult is Transnet, the approved plan in 2004, is functionally, as Colin noted earlier, out of money. So to build anything, whether it's a road, a highway, a new trolley line, at some point it's going to take some more money from somewhere. And I know MTS is now taking it on itself, and I give them credit to do that. I mean, they're proposing something separate from SANDAG.
Yeah, I wonder what it's going to look like, you know, 20, 30, 40 years down the road as we're seeing a younger generation that's perhaps less dependent on automobiles than the older generation. We see them out there, some of them not having cars at all. If they want to go to somewhere they can't get to by transit, they're Ubering or taking Lyft or hopping on an electric scooter or something. So it is kind of a different landscape in the future.
So one thing I want to suggest about the way to look at these transportation plans, what SANDAG's doing, what other advocates have been talking about, is to really focus on what's going to happen 40 years from now. But I think that misses some of the opportunities that we can make improvements in the immediate term. So SANDAG, in very broad strokes of what their plan will look like, it has these big, you know, region-wide rail network. And like, you know, 50 years from now, that'd be great. But one of the things that I'd like to see is what are we going to do to improve things in a more immediate term with more immediately available resources?
I would be remiss not to ask about safety and fire evacuation issues, which I think is important to consider when we're thinking about things like transit and where we put new housing. I'm thinking specifically about Ramona and the Highway 94 corridor down to Jamul, which the state, CAL FIRE, has identified as two of the most dangerous evacuation routes for fire in the state. I don't know if you realized, but Paradise, California was considered to be in the worst 5% for that. The Highway 94 corridor to Jamul is in the worst 1%. It's worse than Paradise. Paradise had 6 evacuation routes, but they just didn't get the word out. Jamul has 2, maybe, you know, if it's not blocked by a fire. So do you have any ideas for trying to make things safer from an evacuation route for the people who already live down there? And what are your thoughts about the proposal before the county right now that would put 1,200 new homes and 4,000 new people in a housing development in what's already among the most dangerous evacuation areas in the state?
So I'm not intimately familiar with the particular proposals that are happening in the backcountry areas for the county, but I think
I should add, this would, what currently before them that they'll be, I think, voting on in late June is a general plan amendment that would make it easier to build these big housing developments. This is the first one coming before the county is the one in the Proctor Valley, Jamul, Otay area.
Okay, but I think as a general matter, we should be really skeptical about trying to put more and more people farther and farther away from places they want to go, right? And so, sure, that there can be a fire danger on that, but it's also something that can create additional traffic, something that can create additional greenhouse gas emissions, that we should be focusing our new development near transit, near where people work, and that's very much in conflict with these ideas about building farther and farther afield.
Yeah.
And if you were to limit building in these rural areas and increase, widen the road, but no more people would be on it because your building was limited, you would solve a lot of your evacuation problems. But clearly these have to be addressed. We have wildfires that seem to be burning every couple of years now, dramatic wildfires. And we cannot forget that a percentage of our population needs to be evacuated. But I agree, infill areas, to promote the development in a smart growth pattern, which they're supposed to be doing, leaving the open areas open. I cannot agree more with that idea.
Okay. I'd like to ask each of you, if you could wave your magic wand, let's start with you, Colin. You could wave your magic wand and you're in charge of creating the ideal transportation plan for our region within what we might consider the most realistic, you know, financial scenario as well. What would your plan be?
Yeah, so my plan would be pretty simple. And this is, I think, very, very much in line with what MTS is actively talking about right now. And that's really prioritizing improved frequency and service where there's an existing demand. And so, for example, we have this trolley network that it's very iconic. It's a big part of San Diego. Most of those lines run only every 15 minutes. They should run every 7 minutes, right? And you could do that with a relatively modest amount of expenses. We also have some bus lines are like not very well ridden, but some of them are ridden really well and they have really great ridership. Mm-hmm. We should be increasing service and frequency and speed for those. And that it costs money. And like in both of these circumstances, what it costs is you have to buy more buses, but the biggest cost is you have to pay more drivers to drive around.
Yeah.
So it's not free, but it's way cheaper than building new
high-speed rail lines. Yeah,
absolutely. It's even cheaper than building light rail lines like the trolley, which can be pretty expensive too. So that's the first thing that I would do. That would be the most cost-effective thing. Those are also things you could do like right away, right? You wouldn't have to like permit it and do a bunch of environmental analyses and do a bunch of hire a bunch of consultants. You could just literally just pay more people and do it right away.
Yeah.
And then the second thing that I would do is I would identify some job centers that are not adequately served by transit, and I would create some new transit lines to serve them. And so I think the obvious cases for those would be Kearny Mesa, which is a major jobs hub, and then also the Sereno Valley area. But those areas are challenged by traffic, and if we could allow more people to get there without having to drive in an individual car, that would improve their lives and it would improve the environment.
Okay. Christine, what would your ideal plan include?
My ideal plan would include the necessary highway improvements that, like the 125-94. I mean, getting that done. And then it would include elements of Colin's plan, which is frequency. You must recognize the differing lifestyles of this great giant county and what they are looking for. And I know lots of people who don't take the public transportation because it's too slow. And as Colin says, you can cheaply and easily, more cost effective, increase it, make it better. And we also need to really tie this all into our home building and growth patterns. You can widen the freeways as many times as you want, and it will always be gridlock if you keep building near them. And back to your earlier question, if you don't build that way and you build near the job centers, you increase density in dense areas that are high transit things. You will have your housing problem taken care of. You will have people who want to ride the transit accessing it quickly and easily. And then the other parts of the county that are not going to be suited for that are given their preferred mode, taking their car. But I think tying it to land use is imperative.
Yeah, and that also helps to preserve those open spaces, the habitat areas that are so negatively impacted when you do go in and build these big sprawl developments that, you know, divide up habitat, threaten some of the endangered species. So there's a lot of benefits, certainly, to the denser development in the populated areas, I think, as well.
And I think both Colin and I are not anti-development, but we are definitely pro-development in the right places.
And I think let me just add to that, if I may. I mean, I think it is true that kind of sprawl development can be attractive for people who are concerned about affordability. Mm-hmm. So if you're starting a family, you know, a lot of the reason that people are moving to Santee is that you can buy a house and start a family with a yard.
They want the backyard. They may not want the high-rise condo if you're raising a family.
Yeah, and so if we're concerned about that more sprawl development, we also have to be willing to embrace the kind of good development that is infill, that is near jobs, that is near transit. And so we really do have to go hand in hand. It's really easy for elected officials to say, oh, that kind of development over there is bad. I would like it somewhere else, but I can't really specify where. That's not an adequate solution to the problem. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big believer that we need to be increasing housing supply, and we have to be willing to say yes to good projects.
Especially affordable. There's certainly an affordability crisis right now in housing as well. So it's another one of those conflicting goals. Everybody wants their open space. Nobody wants more traffic. But we also want our kids to have a place they can afford to live.
Yeah. And so that means we're going to have to be able to say yes to new infill projects near transit.
And adding to that, our population is aging as a whole. And single family residences that the people want to raise their kids in, I think will probably come on the market without sprawl development, as I don't want to take care of my yard in 20 years.
Yeah, the baby boomers were all.
The baby boomers are aging. And so it will become attractive to people who can no longer drive, who don't want to take care of a big yard. And those are the kind of projects that we really need to start building.
We're certainly seeing some movement in that direction already with things like granny flats, where people can now build not just for grandmas anymore, but a unit on your property that could be a rental for someone that needs a little extra income. And that might be housing that a student could live in, or a grown child, or a senior citizen.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And Christine and I actually co-authored legislation at our city council to allow for more of that kind of development. And that's exactly the right kind of approach, where you're not talking about building in a place where there isn't already building. There's already infrastructure and resources there. And it's a very gentle way to increase housing supply where there already is some. But I'll tell you, you know, we got a lot of pushback from people who really didn't want to see any new homes in their own neighborhoods. And,
yeah,
and I think
parking is an issue, I guess, potentially.
I appreciate the feedback that we get from some of those folks who are concerned. But if we're going to say no to the sprawl development and in the backcountry, we need to be able to say yes somewhere. And so I always tell folks, listen, you know, I mean, I appreciate what they're saying, but we do have a housing crisis, and I'm unwilling to not take some steps to actually try to improve it.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting questions raised. I'm going to give each of you the last word here. Christine, what else would you like our listeners to know about the future of transit in San Diego County that we haven't already touched on?
I think it's very important for the listeners to realize they can be part of this process, whether, as Colin mentioned earlier, Elevate 2020, SANDAG's San Diego Forward page. Even if you go to your local council meetings, your local planning group meetings, and you give comment, hey, I'd like to see X, Y, or Z, we want the listeners, the residents of San Diego, the voters, to all be involved in this. And I think often people feel there's a disconnect between the elected officials and what's going on and the agencies, SANDAG, MTS. And so please, please, listeners, get involved. Shoot me an email. Shoot Colin an email. Go to a SANDAG meeting. Go to an MTS meeting. If you can't make those, go to your local city council meeting, whether it's Santee, Vista, San Diego, and let your voices be heard as to what you would like to see or what your visions and ideas are.
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good point. And I know certainly in all my years as a journalist, we've often seen some of the best ideas in government come out of the citizenry, where they may bring something up that the elected officials hadn't really thought about or didn't really realize was a big issue in a community. So it is important to speak out, speak up, and, you know, get on your feet or on the trolley and get down to some of these meetings and let your voices be heard. Colin, I'm going to let you have the final word today. What else would you like our listeners to know on transit?
Yeah, so I think what I'd like people to come away from this conversation with is an understanding that we can actually do some pretty cool things to improve transportation and transit in particular, right? So sometimes when you hear these big plans, like a giant high-speed rail network that's going to take 50 years to build, like it's hard to get your head around that. Maybe that's not really going to happen. Maybe you're not going to see the benefit of that in your lifetime. But we're currently right now building a $2 billion trolley extension from downtown all the way to UCSD. That's happening right now. It's an amazing project. Hmm. We could have more of that in our region. We can also see as I mentioned earlier, with relatively little money, we can improve the existing transit service so that it's more attractive and faster and more convenient for more people. Those are things that really could happen right now. And so, but what it's going to take is going to take elected officials making the right choices. It's going to take citizens pressuring those elected officials to make those right choices. And it's important for people to have their eye on the ball. So sure, yeah, having a big, bold transit vision can be valuable, but let's make sure that that doesn't eclipse the more immediate things that we can get done to improve transportation for everybody.
Yeah, very practical advice, I think. I want to thank both of you for taking the time to join us today. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we have been speaking with La Mesa City Council members Christine Alicio, who's also on SANDAG, and Colin Parent, who's also the director of Circulate San Diego, about the future of transit in San Diego County. Thanks to both of you for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.